Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It's your host, News Director Richard Spezak. I want to welcome you to a new year of Progressive News Network, going toward our third year of broadcasting. We have some important news before we get to our guests. We have some very interesting guests, as always, for you. We have our third and final in the series of interviews with the candidates for the Florida Democratic Party. Miss Allison Tent has agreed to join us. Now, this recording was made after the other two recordings were made, so one could argue that she might have had the advantage of hearing the questions in advance. It was done later. But I think what you'll hear is Ms. Tant speaking in her own voice, her opinions, and that's what we wanted to hear. You know, for a long time, too many times, decisions are made behind closed doors. I want to say I salute the Florida Democratic Party's candidates for agreeing to be questioned, to be interviewed on this show. I thank them for their generosity. I thank them for coming on to a progressive show to hear the questions asked by a fine panel of progressive activists, each in their own way, bringing a different voice to the table. I want to thank Ms. Susan Smith of the Progressive Democratic Coalition. I want to thank Dr. Maureen McKenna, who is First Vice President of the Democratic Women's Club. And I want to thank Ms. Sally Phillips, president of the LGBT League, but she will give you that details later. And then we'll have, after we play Ms. Tant's presentation and interview, we'll then have a brief moment with the ladies. So, ladies and gentlemen, before that, we always do the news. And I have to tell you, there's been a lot of news that's happened since our last show together. And I got to tell you, you know, we are putting this show with the tune, There's a Better World a Coming. And I say that, and I can feel comfortable with that because I know how hard you people out there listening are working every day to make this a better world. They're environmental activists, women's rights activists, human rights activists, economic justice activists, and many, many others. You've heard them on this show every day working hard against all odds, against massive amounts of money, against massive political and media structures that support the other point of view. But I got to tell you, friends, I got to tell you, we are up against it. And there are so many issues right now. Those of you who had some awareness of the Occupy movement know that when these people gathered to petition their government for redress of grievance, to say what's going on with the economics, time after time after time, what we saw was nothing but peaceful protest, but this is what it was faced with.
Demonstration time.
This segment is dedicated to all those people who went out and spoke out against the mortgage foreclosure fraud, people who spoke out at Occupy and were faced with fire hoses, were faced with sprays of pepper spray in the face, were beaten, abused by the officers of the law. Many people thought there was an awfully interesting collusion, it seemed, between federal officials and local police. Well, recent documents released under a Freedom of Information Act show that it went much further than that. You can get access to these Freedom of Information documents by doing a search for Freedom of Information plus Occupy. For example, documents obtained from the FBI and Department of Homeland Security, the Partnership for Civil Justice, released this past week show that the FBI and other intelligence and law enforcement agencies began a campaign of monitoring, spying, and disrupting the Occupy movement at least 2 months before the very first occupation actions began in late September of 2011. As early as August, while acknowledging that the incipient Occupy movement was peaceful in nature, federal, state, and local officials from the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and many fusion centers and joint terrorism task force centers around the country were meeting with local financial institutions and their private security organizations to plot out a strategy for countering the Occupy movement's campaign. Interesting, one document obtained by the PCJ from the Houston Police Office, from the Houston FBI office, refers to what appears to have been a plan by some in the group, the name of which is blacked out in the released documents, to determine who the leaders were of the Occupy movement in Houston and then assassinate them with suppressed sniper rifles, meaning rifles equipped with silencers. The chilling document in question reads as follows. One identified blank, as of October, planned to engage in sniper attacks against protesters in Houston, Texas, if deemed necessary. An identified blank has received intelligence that indicated the protesters in New York and Seattle planned similar protests in Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin, Texas. Blank planned to gather intelligence against the leaders of the protest movement and obtain photographs and then formulate a plan to kill the leadership by suppressed rifle fire. Mass gatherings associated with public protest movements can have disruptive effects on transportation, commercial, and government services, especially when staged in major metropolitan areas. Large-scale demonstrations also carry the potential for violence, presenting a significant challenge for law enforcement. In reality, the only violence at the hundreds of Occupy movement actions during late 2011 and early 2012 across the United States from New York to Boston to Los Angeles to Seattle was perpetrated by heavily armed police. Occupy activists were the victims, not the perpetrators of this violence and criminal behavior. Now it turns out that when some of the yet identified group of organization, possibly even one affiliated with banking interests for all we know, actually plotted to assassinate Occupy activists and leaders, the same intelligence, national, state, and local agencies, instead of protecting the public, turned their backs and did nothing. Perhaps the very loose coalition nature of the Occupy movement, which has consistently avoided having any or following any leaders, in the end saved it from attack, as the plotters with their sniper rifles never were able to ascertain who their target should be. There's a new cybersecurity program designed to protect the power grid, and yet it sparks fears that the intelligence agencies will use it to spy on U.S. citizens. Perfect Citizen was first revealed in 2010 by the Wall Street Journal, but new details emerged last month in documents released by the NSA to the Electronic Privacy Information Center, an internet privacy group that spent 2 years fighting for them under the Freedom of Information Act. Perfect Citizen, what a ring to that. Perfect Citizen, sensitive control systems perform data collection and control of large-scale distributed utilities or provide automation of infrastructure processes. The protection of SCS is essential to mission operations and has become a significant point of interest in support of Department of Defense and intelligence community. Prevention of a loss due to cyber or physical attack or recovery of operational capability after such an attack is crucial to the continuity of the Department of Defense, intelligence community, and the operation of signals intelligence systems. But internet privacy advocates question whether Perfect Citizen violates privately owned corporate computer networks deemed critical infrastructure from digital spying. It's still unclear how sensors would be used to monitor activity because the NSA is the Pentagon's organization charged with collecting and analyzing foreign communications and defending U.S. government communications and computer networks, but has no mission for domestic spying. The NSA has no authorization to intercept U.S. citizens' communications unless specifically authorized by a special court, according to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. On another front, On the good news front for a change, Representative Pafford had this statement just recently. Representative Pafford anticipates yet more corporate tax breaks in the coming year in the Florida legislature. Florida has the fifth best corporate tax system in the United States, as opposed to the bottom of the list, which we're generally at for things like education, health care, or mental health, he said. The governor wants to continue that trend and move us even higher, but the cost of moving us in that direction means less revenue when it comes to things like education. Pafford said he anticipates that the state will stay on its current course of shortchanging the public education. But what you see is a continued trend of moving those tax dollars out to charter schools and to corporate vouchers, which basically undercut public spending on public education. People need to be very clear when the government says education, he's not talking about public education. A couple more stories we do want to at least mention before we get on to the program. There's been more stress over in the Tokyo Fukushima plant. And by the way, this is interesting. Many of us noticed that during the Wisconsin debacle, when the governor there worked to get legislation against unions, there was support for him, for Governor Walker, in local local radio stations. And when petitions were collected to stop them from doing this, the FCC misplaced the petitions to deny broadcast license renewals to Milwaukee radio stations who gave $1 million worth of free airtime to Walker, to the Walker recall campaign. The Federal Communications Commission apparently has lost legal petitions filed to deny the licenses of Milwaukee radio station WISN and WTMJ on November 1st for subsidizing the recall campaign for Governor Walker and about $1 million worth of free airtime while not allowing any supporters of this opponent on the air. Public interest group Media Action Center was informed that its license challenge will be delayed because the FCC cannot find the legal pleadings. Another interesting fact. U.S. drone strikes are down in Pakistan but up in Yemen. In Pakistan, 122 drone strikes in 2010, 72 in 2011, and 46 in 2012. In Yemen, 18 in 2011, 52 in 2012. And between 189 and 308 militants were killed by drone strikes in Pakistan. Between 397 and 532 were killed in Yemen. And drones in Yemen are operated both by the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command. Senator Ron Wyden, opening debate on the renewal of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a reference to British writ of assistance, which allowed constables and customs officials to search houses of American colonists at will. Such abuses led directly to the creation of our Fourth Amendment, which is now under attack by our own government. But ladies and gentlemen, enough of that. We are counting on you. It's your efforts that will keep the Constitution alive. We also have, in addition to Ms. Allison Tant, we have Mr. Tim Carpenter, one of the founders of Progressive Democrats of America. And then to round out the evening, we have Dr. Rachel Sutz-Pienta, who is chair of the Wakulla Democratic Party. She's going to talk about Democratic Party renewal. So without any further ado, let me bring on the recorded interview with Ms. Allison Tant, a candidate for the chair of the Florida Democratic Party. And again, I want to thank her and all of the candidates who agreed to participate in the question. Thank you so much. And here we go with the interview with Ms. Allison Tant Richards. Ms. Tant, come on in.
Great. Hi, I'm here, everyone. Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to be part of the show, and thank you for being patient with me as I've worked out my schedule. I missed the last go-round because I was on an anniversary, wedding anniversary trip with my husband, and as you know, when you have three kids in the house, you don't get a lot of quiet time with your husband, so thank you for being patient with me to work this out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It, I think, is a service to all Democrats in Florida. So, ladies, let me ask you to go ahead, begin your questioning. Again, thank you all for participating. Susan, I think you lead off.
Okay, I'll start by asking Allison to give us just like an elevator speech introduction, 30 seconds to a minute of who you are and why you want to run for the FDP chair position.
All right, well, thank you, Susan. I am a native of Florida, born in Jacksonville, lived my whole life in our state. I've been involved in political and advocacy and progressive causes most of my life. And one of the reasons that I'm most passionate about doing this is I am loath to see the loss of momentum that we saw in 2010 this year around. And I'm just anxious to push us forward, push us farther. I've been very engaged in the Obama efforts and saw firsthand how that ground game and along with the data work, along with the donations, can really forge together to make a very cohesive result occur for all of us on the Democratic and progressive side, and I'm anxious to marshal those forces to keep us moving forward. I'm also very passionate and very, very consumed by this notion that had this last election not gone the way it had, and we didn't have Barack Obama returning to the White House, that we would see a rapid fire deterioration of everything that all of us as Democrats and Democratic women, Democratic men, and progressives hold dear as our values. We would see the war on women continue. We would see the undermining of our safety net for our senior citizens and the tearing down of Medicare. We would see further punishment and deterioration of those programs that for people who, just because of who they love. We would see reversals in acceptance of our Hispanic community in Florida. It would just be one rapid fire attack with greater pressure than we've already endured. So that's why I'm very passionate about pursuing this post, because I feel I want more time, more policies, more Democratic stakeholders at the table to keep these things from happening.
Okay, thank you. My part of the questions are more on FDP policies and processes. And the first question, you mentioned donations, is about fundraising. That is one of the primary goals we know of a chair. So this is a specific question, the question that one of our members had. What would be your fundraising goal in 2013? And what, with the emphasis on new and innovative strategies, would you use to raise that amount?
Well, the fundraising goal last year was $2.4 million. It was exceeded by about $60,000. I want to, of course, up that ante for the state to size of ours, and with everything that we have at stake, it needs to be a much higher number. Just so you know, as I understand it, that the Republicans outraised us like three to four to one. So we need to significantly up what we're doing so that we can be competitive in this field. Because, we were able to overcome the shortfalls and donations because of the ground game that we have, but we have to build in that with the resources to support that. In regards to how we would do that, we need a robust data management program and also the voter contact program that we saw work so well with the Obama campaign. And we need to invest heavily in voter management software, technology, and data processing and programs to make that happen. We've got to keep the voter engagement high and the voter contact high, and that's part of what we want to do. I built in my area a fundraising council. I was chair of the Northwest Florida Finance Council for the campaign, and I raised funds that I did in my area with small donations, not with large donations. I'm talking putting together networks of people who could reach then out to their network to raise $25 donations, $10 donations, $30 donations, small donations to make this go forward. And I'd like to continue to build upon the internet-based donations that the Florida Democratic Party started this time, but enhance them with all the new tools that we can bring to the table.
Okay, thank you. The next question is about the chair's election itself. Do you think the process for selecting the chair is a fair one? If not, how would you change it?
Well, I think there's going to need to be some change up in this process. It's got to be more open. It's got to be open, and it's got to be sort of subject to some rules discussions and some committee discussions, and I'm committed to doing that. That's something we've been having discussions about already, about how we move forward and make this a little bit better system.
Okay. On the primaries, Another thing that I know really frustrates Democrats at the local level is, you know, we have to sign a non-endorsement clause that we won't take a position in a primary, yet the FDP seems to take positions and anoint certain candidates with, you know, with advantages that other candidates don't have. You know, for example, they will send staff to certain candidates and not to others. They'll send fundraising out letters out for one candidate and not for another, talking in primary. Would you change that in order to prohibit the FDP from doing it, or change it in reverse so that the local parties could endorse? Would you do anything with that process?
Well, I think it's an interesting question because it certainly doesn't give them a level playing field. I think that's a problem. I think that the rules have to be the same either, both ways, I think. You know, I don't know why that policy would exist, and I think that we'd have to have it either open across the board or closed across the board. So I think we'll have to be looking at that as closely as we're looking at some of the other rules changes we're talking about. Because I can understand the frustration on that. I've seen it myself.
Okay, and then my last question has to do with the loyalty oath. Should a loyalty oath be required by all Democratic Party officials and leaders? I think we also have seen some of our leadership in the past election, for example. I think there were some elected officials who did not support Kendrick Meek for the U.S. Senate seat. They openly supported the independent candidate in that race. And do you think there's a way to enforce that loyalty oath, or is there anything you have to say about the loyalty oath and Democrats?
Well, I actually have the opinion that we need to have a loyalty oath, one to the other as well as to the electeds. I mean, the whack-a-mole kind of game that goes on within some of these organizations is very distracting, and it takes too much airtime to resolve differences between folks. But in terms of the loyalty oath, I do think that that's got to be looked at. I have experienced this in my own chapter in Leon County. And that is something that the enforcement seems to need some beefing up. The bylaws are very clear on that, but you can dismiss someone for that by virtue of a two-thirds vote. And the question is, how do you do that in our local BEC? And you've got to look at your membership on that. But, yes, I do believe that the enforcement mechanism needs to be reviewed and put into practice.
Okay, that finishes up my portion, so thank you, and I'll turn it over to Maureen McKenna.
Yes, Allison, I'll be asking questions about the Democratic Executive Committees and candidates. Mm-hmm. What long-term strategies would you employ to recruit, develop, and train more women, LGBT, youth, and minorities into leadership positions within the party?
That is really where it's at, and how we grow our party and how we grow our activism. I'm really glad you asked that question. I think that we need to be looking at, first of all, I think all of the credential committees of our local PECs need to be very aggressive about looking at the vacancies in our precinct captain levels, and we need to be working with local opinion leaders, community activists, local elected Democrats, and advocacy groups for health care, children's issues, education issues, et cetera, to identify people who should be plugged in and recruited to be part of our structure. I think that they should be partnered with on committee in their committee work with existing longtime members of DEC leaders, and then mentored into how to become active and leader, active members, and very proactive in getting things, finding their voice and helping them be productive members of our local DEC. I think that that's where you would start. You would start with the partners in your community and bring in more people into your DECs. Likewise, you would support. The DECs need to be supportive of our Young Democrat clubs, our you know, women's clubs, our GLBT clubs, all of the clubs that are outside of our DEC. We need to be mutually supportive and working together to achieve a unified result.
Thank you. What long-term strategies would you implement to identify, mentor, and train more women, LGBT, youth, and minorities in order to in order to prepare them for running a successful political campaign?
Well, one of the things that we have seen is that the Democrats who had won these last several elections are men and women who are part of the fabric of their communities. They are involved in a number of civic and community organizations. So what I would do is look at, and I am actively doing this in my own areas, recruiting people to boards and groups that I am part of so that I think would be good potential leaders to step up down the road into community organizations, and then helping them network in the community that we live in the communities that we live in, so that they are not starting from ground zero with no contacts, no understanding of what's happening in the communities that they're trying to then serve, and then plugging them in to local and city council. And, you know, we have in our community a number of study commission groups, and I work actively to get people committed and also appointed to those kinds of groups, looking at energy, looking at the environment, looking at education, looking at transportation for disability groups, looking at children's issues. So I work hard on making people that I think of as a good opinion leader and someone who should be groomed for public office. I look to plug them in their community, and then I look to move them up in their community so that then they can participate in an elected office with some strength. The other thing is, I think we need to look at all of those groups that are out there, and you choose people and recruit people from those groups after we've given them some mentoring and some help into local and city county commission races and into our local DECs, and mentor and provide them. There's also lots of training out there through Emily's List and Ruth's List and some of the Progress New Florida work that's being done, and we need to bring all those resources to bear, all of our partners out there together, to help give our folks some support. I think it can be done.
Thank you.
So also, in regards to the young people, there is a Young Electeds Network that's very active. I work very closely with them on all of these same issues. So that's how I would start.
Thank you. What are your plans to show support for local candidates in the 67 counties, and how would you determine which races are viable?
Well, that's an interesting – first, it goes back to our opinion leaders. It goes back to the ability to help them raise funds. It goes back to how we have identified them all along. And it goes back to the building of these networks in our communities and in our DECs to make sure that we are putting into place candidates that we have supported through the building of their resumes, so to speak, and then getting them plugged in where they need to be so that we can make them viable candidates long before they just show up and say, hey, I feel like running. But I do know that there are, you know, ways that are, those assessments are being done, and it's based on how they're woven into the fabrics of their communities, how much money they can raise, how much support they can engender, and those are things we need to, those are things that are based on now. So we just have to help work on that before they get there. But yes, those are all things that need to be done.
The next question is about swing county versus 67 county strategy. How would you balance the need to target party resources with the need to recruit viable candidates for every statewide race?
Well, first of all, we should not have any races go uncontested. We did have that this last go around. I particularly, you know, want to focus on several types of our cabinet positions to make sure that we are very actively engaged with a candidate that can win at the cabinet level, and just go ahead and we need to pick some of those off. I was very discouraged this last election, but despite our gains, and thankfully we did have some gains this last go around statewide, that we did have some seats that were just, we didn't field a candidate in, and we cannot let that happen again. Part of it is we have a culture of fear that candidates aren't going to win, so then consequently we don't run anybody, but that's how people burnish their honor and get in and get vetted, get through that system and build some name recognition so that they can win. So we have to deal with candidates every single time. How we look at that, That's a really good question. And we have to look at the swing counties. We're working on a little bit of that right now with progress. I'm thankful it's not my dog. We're looking at that right now with Project New Florida and how we appeal to voters who are not politically attuned and who are swing voters. And so that's all data that's being mined and worked on right now.
What measures would you put in place to assist DECs, clubs, and caucuses in building membership?
Well, it's what I went back to, what I spoke to earlier today, earlier in the discussion, is that our credentials committee need to be highly focused on recruiting quality individuals based upon the networks that they have in their own communities and people who want to serve to our DECs. I want to make sure that we are looking at folks who are plugged in with their communities, looking at folks who opinion leaders and elected officials and advocacy groups can get behind and they can work with. I want folks who have their own networks of people who can write checks, people who can engage in campaigns, people who want to walk neighborhoods, things of that nature. And we need to train them. We need to give them some idea of what their roles are supposed to be once they're there. We need more support for our precinct captains, for our committeemen and women, so that we have everyone has a much better understanding of what they're to do. And then we need to make it so that the tasks that they then engage in are effective, and they feel that they're contributing, and they feel valued for their commitment and their training. So I would like to beef up all of the training for them. I would like to beef up access to data and to making it a pleasure to serve in our communities for Democrats.
Will you support development of a nonprofit FDP mailer which would allow DECs to buy in and in so doing be able to take advantage of FDP's nonprofit postage rate?
It seems to me to be a fairly simple ask. It seems easy to me to say yes to. I don't know where that stands at this moment and why there wouldn't be such a thing, but it seems like that would be an easy thing to do. If we have the capability, we ought to do it. That seems like that's a core mission that we ought to be engaged in every DEC, and so the answer to that is yes. What I'd like to do is look at best strategies across our state, or best practices, rather, across our state of what our best functioning DECs are doing in that area, and look at how we can adopt those practices across our state and across other DECs. I'd also like to look at what some of the other states whose maybe demographics are similar in terms of a particular area, small county, large county, medium county, and how they do it so that we can bring those resources to bear. This seems to be a very simple thing to look at doing, and the training ought to be provided.
Would you charge Democratic candidates for use of the van, or would you provide it free of charge? Please explain.
Well, I know that a lot of Democratic candidates are struggling already, you know, to pay filing fees and everything else to use the van. But I understand, it's my view that the van needs updating, and we're working on doing, I'm already talking to folks about doing that so we can update it to be similar to what was utilized for voter contact, voter engagement, and voter identification with the Obama campaign. So I think that's going to get easier for us to do in terms of charging. That is an issue. I think this is just such a struggle for Democratic candidates to be able to pay an extra fee on top of filing fees. And maybe we can work out a strategy for, not unlike the signature collection, where we make it easier for our candidates to use the van. But it ought to be available through the maybe to their DECs, you know? So that's something we need to be looking at. Is it a uniform practice across the counties now?
Are you asking me, is it a universal?
Yes. Is it charged now?
Right.
Yes.
Candidates.
For candidates, it is charged.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm sure that it's an issue of, I'm sure, economics, but I think that we need to be looking at that and making it easier for our Democratic candidates to run than not.
And my last question, in what way would you change ban usage and access for local DECs, clubs, and caucuses?
Well, I believe that I have access to the van now, and I think that, like I said, I believe, as I mentioned previously, I believe that the van needs to be updated, and I believe that the access to it needs to be easier for our candidate, for our clubs, and for our DECs. But I think we're going to be looking at updating that whole system.
Thank you. That was my last question. Now I'm going to turn it over to Sally.
Go ahead, Sally.
Okay. All right. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah. You want to turn down your computer in the background. We can hear the echo.
Okay. Is that better?
Yep.
Okay, great. Now, hi, Allison. How are you?
Fine, Sally. How are you?
Good. We appreciate you being on. The questions that I'm going to ask are focused on legislative issues where it comes to marriage equality, abortion rights, ERA, public education amendments. And the first three are going to be yes or no.
Okay.
The first is, would you publicly call for a marriage equality, and would you sign the Freedom to Marry pledge?
Yes.
Okay. Second question, would you publicly call for passage of the Equal Rights Amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Third, would you publicly support a woman's right to make her own reproductive choices?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now we're going to talk about platform issues. Considering that marriage equality was not specifically included in the FDP platform, but is in the DNC platform, will you work to include it in the FDP platform in the future?
Yes. I was very disappointed that was not done this time. It's gross.
Okay.
Group.
Okay. Now, follow up to that. What would you do as an FDP chair to advocate for the FDP and the DNC platform, especially as it relates to marriage equality, abortion rights, the Equal Rights Amendment, public education, and future ballot initiatives?
I think that's fairly easy. I think that's something I would do I would like to see us with all of that adopted in our platform. I would like to see the DNC. There should be no daylight on those issues between us and the DNC, and I think that we already have those things on the platform. We need to be uniform between the state and the DNC platform, and I would advocate for that across the board on all of those issues.
Okay, and then the last one was the ballot initiatives, like amendments to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes. Those are critical issues, and I think that we definitely would need to do that. Part of the issue there, of course, is the signature collection in order to get them on the ballot and have them there, and to pursue them through the legislative arena, we have to have enough Democrats to put them on the ballot through the legislative arena. So we have a lot. We would be starting from a deficit, but we would have to do that. And I think that inclusion from the DNC level would be a key to helping us be successful to get more items on the ballot. But we have a lot of work to do on the ground game
on
that.
Well, and I think specifically that question, and I know where it came from, specifically on Amendment 2, when the FDP did not take a position on Amendment 2. And we feel very strongly, we within the GLBT community feel very strongly that the FDP should have taken a position, but there are other amendments to the Constitution, we feel like we need to take a position on.
Absolutely. That amendment loss I took just so hard. I couldn't believe that went down. No, that would be something we would have to advocate for. That would have to be part and parcel of what we do. There's no way the FDP can sit that out.
Okay.
I took that one personally.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Next, do you favor developing a strategy along with the state and federal legislators that would be more proactive in supporting our platform stances through the through legislation.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. I would favor that. And part of that, the biggest part of that, is getting more Democrats elected so we have more voices to be said. So yes, I would.
Okay, and my final question, actually my second to final question, what would be your strategy to reach out and recognize the particular groups within our party, such as the Women's Caucus of Florida, the GLBT Caucus, the Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, the Young Democrats, and the Progressive Caucus, and of course there's the Disability Caucus, there's the Environmental Caucus, you know, we have many caucuses throughout. But what would be your strategy to recognize these caucuses as leaders and their members within the FDP planning and policy implementation?
They have to be equal partners with us. The reason that there are these caucuses is because they represent the very core values that we all have as Democrats, and they need to be at our table, at our side. They need to be a vibrant voice of leadership and how the FDP does its work and how the Democratic electeds do their work across our state. And I would love, my plan would be to have them as partners at the table of everything that we do going forward. I'm thankful for the hard work. I know that I'm thankful for the fact that the Disability Caucus, the Environmental Caucus, the GLBT Caucus. I'm just thankful for all of the commitment that everyone has to advancing our issues, because we are such a broad tent, and then we need all of our partners working together to make the difference happen across our communities that have. So we have to have them as equal partners with everything that we do. We have to have strong representation and a strong voice. I would support more as much as we can do to strengthen their voices as possible.
Okay. Well, thank you. Now, my final question, and this is something we asked the other two candidates when we had them on. Could you give your contact information? So if any of the folks out there would like to contact you direct, either both an email and a phone, maybe a cell phone or something?
Sure. It's Allison Kant. That's A-L-L-I-S-O-N, T as in Tom, A-N-T, all lowercase, all one word, @gmail.com. And my phone number is 850-251-6040.
Okay. Well, we thank you very much. And now I'm going to turn this back over to Rick. Thanks a whole lot.
Thank you so much for joining us. I do have one other question that we've asked of all the candidates. And this is regarding the next election. And the question is this. Regarding Charlie Crist and other candidates, would you assist in clearing the way for Charlie Crist to represent our party in 2014, or would you actively encourage a Democratic primary if he gets into the race?
It's got to be a Democratic primary. If he gets in the race, he cannot have any assistance from the Democratic Party. He's going to have to make his own case to the Florida voters. It's going to be totally the call of the Florida voters as to how they proceed with that election. And I'm of the thought that he's not going to need a lot of help from anybody to make his case. He's going to have to do it all on his own. So, no, it's got to be a wide-open race, and all of the candidates have to have a fair shot.
Well, thank you so much. And I do want to make this one small suggestion.
Okay.
In the past, some members of the party have felt that the progressive community wasn't fully backing. And what we've said in the past is reach out to us and we'll be glad to give you a platform and provide additional ways for you to outreach and for you to speak to our community. And I just want to extend that invitation. Should you be elected, or even if you're not and you're still involved in the party, please feel free to contact us and we'll be glad to share some space with you and let you get your message out through our medium as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that very kind offer. I am heavily engaged in progressive work. I did work very hard on the Awake the State rallies, and we had a big women's rally, warm women's rally back in April that I was very engaged in with my community. I've been very engaged in education, public education issues on the progressive side, as well as the Project New Florida work and the Pinkford Flip. So I really am very thankful for everything that you all on this call are doing, and appreciate your hearts and your intellect. I know you sacrifice time, sleep, and your own funds, and it does make a difference, and you are making a difference, and I'm very, very thankful. So thank you for that offer. I appreciate it. I will take you up on it.
Thanks again. And that was the interview with Allison Tan. I'd like to bring on my next guest, the national activist, the leader of Progressive Democrats of America, Mr. Tim Carpenter. Tim, welcome.
Hey, Richard, how are you? Thanks for having me on tonight.
Oh, it's our pleasure, sir. You provide, I think, a really wonderful view of both your work inside the party, your work, I'm going to say outside the party, even though Progressive Democrats of America has such a unique position. Could you talk a little bit about yourself first, and how you came to take this, what I think is a really interesting approach on working both with the party and as with the larger activist community who doesn't feel quite comfortable being assimilated?
Well, thanks again, Richard, for the opportunity. Progressive Democrats of America was founded in 2004 following the Democratic National Convention. I personally at that time was a deputy campaign manager for Congressman Dennis Kucinich out of Ohio. I'm sure many of your listeners, of course, were part of that campaign. It was our belief at that time and our belief today that the Democratic Party needs to hold to those principles that unite us as progressives. And when we say both inside and outside the party, as progressive Democrats in the tradition of Franklin Delano Roosevelt all the way up through Adlai Stevenson, Bobby Kennedy, George McGovern, and where we find ourselves today with Barbara Lee and with your own Alan Grayson. So we're the progressive wing. I was a campaign manager for Dennis at that time. If many people can remember, in 2004, the issues that a lot of us were active are the same issues tonight that we're talking about on this radio show, whether it be the question of military expenditures, wasteful profligate military spending in the face of worsening unmet human needs. At that time in 2004, our nation was embarked on the occupation of Iraq. Tonight, we're bogged down in Afghanistan. At the same time, 47 million Americans were without health insurance, even more tonight. So we believe that the Democratic Party then and today should be the party that talks about redirecting military spending and getting it back here at home. And how we do that through an inside-outside strategy along the other issues that we work very closely on, whether it be on the environment or campaign finance reform. We believe that we have to work, as you said, Richard, both inside the party. We've got to do as you've been doing tonight, drilling those candidates that are working at the state, local, and national level. And at the same time, we've got to reach out to our friends, our neighbors, and our comrades who are working in those organizations, whether they be Peace and Justice, the environmental community, religious communities, to bring them inside the Democratic Party, the street heat, we refer to it as. Those are the folks that risk arrest, that stand on the vigils, that do the candlelight vigils. We've got to bring that heat inside the Democratic Party. And it's part of a long tradition. We can go back all the way to Seneca Falls, when Elizabeth Cady Stanton began the women's suffrage movement to begin to give women the right to vote. It started in Seneca Falls, as we know, in 1848, but it ended with the women's movement outside the gates of the White House enforcing President Wilson to move towards women's right to vote. But we can follow Rosa Parks when she sat down on a bus and simply said she was tired and was not going to go to the back of the bus, and that lit a spark that led to Martin Luther King being in the Rose Garden with President Johnson to sign the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. So we've got to work both inside the party. We've got to move our party to its progressive roots. And we've got to bring our friends that are frustrated with the electoral process to come back to be part of this movement. So I think that's probably the short narrative to get us rolling tonight.
Tim, I'd like to compliment you on something that I don't know if you've heard enough about. I was asked to be an official progressive blogger to the convention before last in Denver. And there was a progressive Democratic convention there, a counter convention. And I have to tell you, I attended both, and I was so inspired by what was done at that progressive Democratic convention there. I think you brought together some wonderful people, some great minds, some great hearts. And I was more inspired by the event that PDA held than I have to admit I was by the national convention, as wonderful as it was, with all the keynotes that it was. Your organization, PDA, stands as a bridge, I think, between those idealists who believe that unless we are stalwart and keep pressing toward the future, those forces that slow things down, and speaking frankly, a lot of corporate interests that too many Democrats are lost in. Unless we are stalwart, it's not going to happen.
Well, thanks, Richard. And that event you spoke of 4 years ago, we did the same thing in Charlotte around the National Convention this past year, and we'll be doing it again around the inaugural. So I do tonight want to encourage folks that are listening, if you're going to be in D.C. for the inaugural on the Saturday the 19th prior to Martin Luther King's birthday, we're going to do a similar event as you spoke of, Richard. We're going to be gathering some of the best progressive minds inside our party, whether they be Alan Grayson, your good a new member returning that we're excited about in Florida, or John Conyers, the senior member of both the Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus, Raul Grijalva, the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, Jim McGovern, who serves as the second-ranking Democrat on the Rules Committee, are all going to be there, as well as Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies and Medea Benjamin from Code Pink, who's going to be out in Florida in a couple of weeks. All of these folks will be coming back again, Richard, and we think this is an excellent opportunity. Progressive Democrats of America tries very much to create that space, as you spoke of, where we can have an honest discussion and dialogue, not just a lot of speeches and rah-rah, but to really have an exchange of ideas and talk strategically. It's one thing to send an email, and it's another thing to stand in front of a congressional office, but we need a sustained effort working both within our own organizations and to reach out. We have to get out of our silos and work with those other organizations. That's what PDA tries to model, and we'll be doing that again, as I said, out in Washington, and I encourage folks to go to pdamerica.org tonight, get registered for that, and later that night, we're going to be at Busboys and Poets to do some celebrating as well. As bleak as it may seem at the national level, in some regards, there is a lot to celebrate. We plan on doing that on that Saturday night. We hope that folks will join us. And we're very proud of those events. They're called Progressive Central. This will be the third one that we've done, Richard. Again, even if you can't make it, go to the website. Make sure you follow us. We'll be doing a webcast on that as well. So
excellent.
If you can't get out to Washington, D.C., you can follow it as well.
You know, that's so important. That too many times, wonderful organizations pull events together and seem yet to not be quite aware of the fact that many people who would buy in, who are emotionally at one with the movement, just can't afford the travel. And with the power of the web as a communications medium to deliberate, to distribute these events via the web, I think that's absolutely the way to go. Let me ask you a strategy question, sir. Today, for the very first time on Sunday morning's Talking Heads circuit of mainstream media, I heard a good Democrat, Nancy Pelosi, mention for the first time in my hearing, and I follow this argument closely, when the subject of entitlements came up, she finally mentioned the military. What do you say to people who seem so have such tunnel vision on social programs as the only answer to the question of entitlements?
Well, you really hit what is unique about PDA. As I said, when we were founded in 2004, it was Congressman Dennis Kucinich who led 121 Democrats to vote against the occupation and the war in Iraq. And so here we are tonight. We know the $1.5 trillion that will have been wasted in both Iraq and Afghanistan, where that money could have been better spent. And to think tonight that we're still bogged down in Afghanistan. It's a fundamental question, Richard, and it's one that PDA has addressed from the beginning. We as a nation have to define what national security means in real terms. It's not by measuring bombs or how many military bases we have around this country. National security, real security, should be measured by how many people we're housing, how many people we're feeding, and what kind of health care we're delivering. And that's the debate that PDA has been engaged in. That's why we work very closely with Barbara Lee and Jim McGovern. It's time to cut military spending and redirect military spending. We're in a bogus debate right now. We should not be talking about austerity. We should be talking about prosperity. We as a progressive movement have to reframe this debate, and we're pushing as hard as we can. It's nice to see that Nancy's joined in that chorus, but what we need is a revenue stream. We need to talk about taxing Wall Street. We need to talk about bringing in a revenue stream, not cutting our way out through programs like Social Security and Medicare. In fact, we should be talking about strengthening Social Security and expanding Medicare for all. So that's a fundamental question within PDA, and it's what distinguishes PDA from all the other inside the Beltway groups, is to unify those groups that are working outside the party to bring that message. The American Friends Service Committee, outgoing Congressmember Barney Frank, who we hope will be our new senator here in Massachusetts.
Wouldn't that be nice?
put together a report that showed over the course of the next 10 years, we could cut $1 trillion from the military budget and not hurt our national security at all. So that's what a fundamental issue and what separates PDA from most of these other organizations. Right after the election, when President Obama was beginning to capitulate and throw in the towel yet again on the Social Security debate, it was PDA leading the charge with many of our peace and justice friends, whether they be Code Pink or Peace Action, who said it's time to cut military spending. It's a fundamental reality. We can begin that process right now with sequester. We don't have to be bogged down in this whole question of austerity. We need to talk about prosperity, not austerity. We can cut military spending. We need to defend and be proud of Social Security. We don't need to be spending our time talking about cutting Social Security or even think about cutting Medicare and Medicaid. Those are programs at work. These are legacies of the Democratic Party we should be proud of, and we should be talking about going to the military, as you just said it. I'm sorry I missed the Nancy, and I hope our speaker again in the next 2 years will help us to lead that effort to redirect military spending. We don't need bases in Germany. We don't need bases in Korea right now. We need to begin to bring those bases and those workers back here to the United States and put them back to work here.
And you know as well as I do that the death merchants would just as soon love to see another war in Iran. They'd love to see a growth of our African presence. I mean, you know, the war drums that these people are trying to drum up, you know, they see an unlimited military budget, but only strictures when it comes to social programs.
Well, that was the issue for me as a young person. When I began my political activism, I began during the Reagan military buildup. People may not remember in 1980 when President Reagan was elected, he wanted to spend over $1 trillion to upgrade our nuclear weapon capacity. He believed we could fight and win a nuclear war. We were placing first-strike nuclear weapons in Europe. That was the birth of the Green Party. So this is a fight that's in our DNA at PDA. The waste of military money and the expenditures at the cost of human needs has only continued over the course of the last 20 to 30 years to grow. It's a fundamental issue, and I do hope tonight one of the ways we address that within Progressive Democrats is the third Wednesday of every month, folks, in Florida, led by Sandy Davis out in Miami, by Mike Fox, who's our state organizer out there, Janice,
great people,
who does our
great
social media, who came out of Florida. All of us are very engaged in what we call a letter drop campaign. As we began tonight, Richard, you said not everybody can get to Washington, and we understand that, but we can all get to our own congressional member's office. We can take one lunch hour a month and go to our member of Congress and deliver a letter that says specifically, we want you to join with Barbara Lee and support congressional efforts to get us out of Afghanistan. We want you to support and work with John Conyers to put together a job stimulus program. We want you to work with Keith Ellison so that we can begin to tax Wall Street. So the third Wednesday of every month, folks are doing that. As I said, in Florida, we've got a lot of this going on where people deliver a letter to their member of Congress. So as frustrating as that may be when we get off a radio show and some people wonder what is one simple thing I can do, you can give up your lunch hour and deliver these letters. We call them the letter drop campaign. If you go to pdamerica.org, if you go to our Facebook page, Mike Fox and Janice are working tonight to bring all that information to you. You can find where people in your local community are part of this effort. One of the great things about radio shows like this tonight is to connect those of you who very much want to be part of this to find out where you can plug in. And as you said, Richard, we don't all have to travel to Washington. We can do this in our own backyard with our own neighbors. So visit the PDA website, visit our Facebook pages, let Mike Fox and Janice know how we can help you and be part of this letter drop campaign.
Tim, let me ask you a question. You know, there's a lot of talk about tipping points. And, you know, we've got so many environmental issues in front of us, so many economic justice issues in front of us. Whether we talk about the, I suppose, the eventual release of the pipeline, the continuing drumbeat of GM foods, the threats to water and air, these calls for deregulation. Do you see some place out in, whether it be in 13 or and maybe in the approach to the election in 14, that there's going to be enough people aware of what's going on that we're going to see a mass movement to demand change?
Oh, I get up every day, Richard. I'm one of those people that always finds the glass half full. I get out of bed and encourage when I hear groups like I Matter, a group of 14, 15, 13-year-olds who've organized to push the U.S. government to hold them accountable for what we've done to the environment, for them to take us to federal court, similar to what folks did in the tobacco industry in regards to cancer. These are young activists that are working on the environmental question, or the work that Bill McKibben's doing at 360.org. I'm very encouraged by that work. I'm very encouraged by what's happening. You don't see it in the corporate media, of course. It's through radio programs like this and through the website and through community meetings where people are coming together. I get up every day with a bounce in my step, because I'm plugged in. I'm fortunate enough to be part of a growing community of people that believe that we can make a difference, that you can make a difference working at your local level, working at the congressional level, as we said, to help elect members of Congress, to help hold them accountable not only in Washington when they're there, but inside our own Democratic parties. Here in Massachusetts, we've been working and passing resolutions at the state level in support of cutting military spending, in support of single payer. And we're doing it not just in states like Massachusetts. We're doing it in Arizona. We're doing it in New Mexico. So I'm very encouraged. I'm very hopeful. The numbers of PDA continue to grow and the work that we're doing. As you were inspired, as you said earlier, when you came to Progressive Central in Denver, I encourage those of you who come on January 19th to Washington, D.C., you're going to see an auditorium full of activists, and not just, as I said, talking strategically, but some of the best things that happen at these conferences are the folks that are tabling to go out into the hallways and to visit all the various tables, whether it be Public Citizen or Code Pink or Democratic Socialists of America or Progressive Democrats of America, meeting activists at those tables and making those connections to be part of this larger movement. PDA is proud. We play a small role as an electoral piece of our larger social movement, and we're on the move. A majority of Americans are ready for single payer. A majority of Americans are ready to bring their troops home from Afghanistan. A majority of Americans are ready for some real gun control. So what we needed to do is stay focused, keep our eyes on the prize, continue to not only send our emails, but to get out, to deliver our letters to Congress and be part of this movement.
If you were going to say that there is one, there's so many battles ahead of us. Is there one focus of PDA, or are you working on several battle fronts at once?
Well, there's a lot going on, and it's tough to get focused. And what we've done within Progressive Democrats of America is we're bottom-up, and we mean that sincerely. The issues that we're involved in are driven by our chapters. We're based by the activists that are on the ground. We were formed, as I said, in 2004, and at that time we identified fundamental issues that unite us as Progressive Democrats. So every month we meet virtually on the phone on the issues that we've identified as PDA. We think they're all connected, beginning with Citizens United, the $6 billion that was just spent this last election cycle. We've got to move to public financing. Until we deal with that question, it's going to be hard to do anything else. So one of the overriding issues we work very closely on is the whole question of Citizens United, to hold corporations accountable. Corporations are not people, as we know, and Jim McGovern has legislation and constitutional amendment to overturn that. So that's a very important issue for us. As you heard tonight, we were founded on the issue of cutting military spending and meeting human needs. So we have a call every month with our health care as a human right. Regardless of what happens with the Affordable Care Act, we've got a lot of work to do tonight. 47,000 Americans will be threatened and die in hospitals across this country next year because they have no health insurance. So we've got to deal with that question. So we're very active there. The military question, as we said, we've got to work with poverty. We've got to bring the troops home. So these are the fundamental issues for PDA. And the last one I think I'll leave you on, Richard, again, if you come to Progressive Central, you'll hear from Keith Ellison, the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus. We've got to help Main Street. Enough about Wall Street. It's time to start arresting some of these CEOs in Wall Street and taxing Wall Street. And the way we can do that is through what we call the speculation tax or the Robin Hood tax, which has been used in Europe. Congressman Keith Ellison will begin legislation to tax those members on Wall Street that make those financial transactions. And that money alone could raise upwards of $100 to $300 billion that we could direct to help stimulate our economy and move us forward. So that's a kind of a cross-section of a buffet table for PDA activists. I hope there's something there that speaks to folks. It's very hard to bring it down to one or two issues, but those are the issues we've identified as Progressive Democrats. We think by getting a handle on those, we can begin to not only turn this party around, but get this nation back to the work we so desperately need to do to meeting human needs.
Thank you so much. You've been so articulate on such a wide range of issues, and I did not relish asking you that question, although it needed to be asked. Let me ask you another question, sir. I'm sure you and a lot of other progressives like me tuned into the Republican convention, and we heard some heartless, cruel statements made about people should just die and cheering when they didn't have health care. It seems to me that the Democratic Party hasn't taken a hard look at that and said, we have to be the opposite. We have to embrace the health care challenge. Do you see any champion in Congress or?
Oh, sure. People, Richard, should definitely, if you haven't already, contact Congressman John Conyers. Congressman John Conyers out of Michigan is the author of H.R. 676, which is the Medicare for All, Enhanced Medicare for All bill, which basically is to bring us towards single payer. Nobody out, everybody in. It would be publicly financed and privately run. It's a program that we can very much move towards. There were over 70 members of Congress that were co-sponsors of the bill last year, and we'll be working on it again this year. And that's why we're excited to have Alan Grayson, who will be returning to Congress, to be part of this effort. There are those in Congress that understand this issue very much. Dennis Kucinich, unfortunately, was turned out this last election cycle, but working with Congressman Conyers has championed H.R. 676. That's a fundamental bill for us. Now, we also need to be realistic. We're not going to pass single payer, given the president that we have right now and the Congress as it's made up. But it doesn't mean we can't continue to fight at the national level for that and then work at the state level. We have to chew gum and walk at the same time. We have to work toward a national program at the federal level and then at the state level. Vermont, California, Massachusetts have all introduced bills at the state level to begin to get federal waivers to allow us to take our Medicare money and redirect it so that we can have state single-payer bills, similar to what Tommy Douglas did back in Canada in the early 50s with Saskatchewan and those other regions, and move towards a national health care program. So that fight's very much part of PDA. Again, it's in our DNA. Health care is a human right. Go to the website. Be a part. Every month we have those calls. Donna Smith, who many of your listeners will remember from the Michael Moore documentary, is the co-chair of our National Healthcare and Warfare Campaign. That's a fight we're very much engaged in.
Well, again, I can't thank you enough for all the work that you've done for the last four decades and the work that you continue to do. Let me ask you maybe what might be a slightly easier question for a change. You know, you had the good fortune to work on the Kucinich campaign. Now that he's out of Congress this term, do you know what his plans are? Is he going to continue to work outside? Is he going to try to mount a campaign to get back in 2 years? Do you know? What can you say?
Well, you need to know that Dennis is certainly not going to slow down. As one door closes, another door will open. I'm not sure Dennis himself knows tonight ultimately where he's going to land, but he'll continue to be that voice. If you haven't registered on the PDA website, please do that, pdamerica.org. We'll keep you apprised of what Dennis is up to. He's going to be with our PDA chapter out in Santa Barbara, California, next month, receiving an award from the anti-nuclear groups out there. It's in his DNA, as we've been saying all night. He's going to be engaged. Whether it be running again, we don't know tonight, Richard, but what we do know is that he will continue to be engaged. He probably gave one of the best speeches at the closing of Congress last week. Those of you who didn't hear it, go to his website and hear his words. He will continue to be engaged both at the national and at the local level. That's who he is. I know for a fact that the Department of Peace, which was the bill that he carried for some time, will now be carried by Barbara Lee. He's going to continue certainly to work on that. His commitment to national health care, single-payer health care, as strong as it's ever been. So keep an eye on Dennis. We've always laughed with him, PDA, even though we came out of his presidential campaign. We would laugh oftentimes not knowing which way he was going to turn himself. That's what's unique about Dennis. But you can rest assured tonight that he will continue to be an engaged and a vibrant member of the progressive community, whether it be inside the Washington Beltway or back out here in the streets with many of the listeners tonight.
Thank you. There's so many of us out here that support the excellent work he's done for so long. Let me ask you one other question, sir, before I let you close with a word or two of wisdom from your point of view. Let me ask you about that new senator you have in Massachusetts. So many of us have just great hope for the good Dr. Warren.
Oh, with good reason. I'm one of the most happiest things for us on election night here in Massachusetts was to be a part of that campaign. We knew early on, even before she announced, how lucky we were to have her as a candidate. And tonight, the fact that she's in the U.S. Senate, we were there last week when the new members were being sworn in. We're very excited in Massachusetts. We're also catching our breath because of the news now with Senator Kerry. We're going to have another Senate race out here. We've got to defeat Scott Brown yet again, and we hope that Ed Markey will move from the House to the Senate on that front. But in regards to Elizabeth Warren, one of the most exciting things, I think, for many of the progressives on election night was to watch the Senate. Nice surprises, whether it be Tam involvement out in Massachusetts or Elizabeth Warren here in Massachusetts, to have real progressive women who will be going to the Senate and really fight on those issues. As I said tonight when we began, Richard, we need those champions that understand that we've got to hold Wall Street accountable. It's time now to move to Main Street and not just talk about the middle class, but to talk about the poor and to talk about those, as we said, that don't have the health insurance. And she will be one of those voices in the Senate. Many people are laughing already tonight in Massachusetts and saying, watch out, Hillary can't make it in 2 years. She might be the next woman presidential candidate you'll hear quite a bit from. But we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We're very excited in Massachusetts to have Elizabeth Warren on her way now on the banking committee and to begin that process to be a real voice for not only reform but real structural change in Washington. And to have her be our senator is very exciting in Massachusetts. And as I said, now Senator Kerry in the process of moving on to become our next Secretary of State, we're going to have a chance, it looks like, to elect Ed Markey to the Senate. And I am very fortunate. I'm in western Massachusetts, where my congressman is Jim McGovern. So if all of you listening tonight could have Jim McGovern and Elizabeth Warren as your representatives in Washington, this country and this nation will be in a much better position than we find ourselves tonight.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm looking forward to the first meeting of the Banking Committee, because I think that Dr. Warren is going to do a little taking to the woodshed.
Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Well, sir, let me ask you just to sum up, if you would, what people should know about PDA and how to get in touch.
Well, again, Richard, thank you for the opportunity tonight. And those who are listening, and I know in a webcast, in a podcast, we can get this out. So I hope people that are listening, if there's anything tonight that inspired you, that you'll share this with your friends and neighbors. I think the most important thing we like to leave you with in Progressive Democrats of America is a warm welcome to be part of the growing Progressive Democrats of America community. We're not an organization in the traditional sense. I hope tonight in hearing that we believe we are part of a larger social movement. If you're listening to this radio station, you get it. We need you to be plugged in and be a part of that. How can you do that? Simply go tonight to the Facebook page, the Florida Facebook page. Let Mike Fox, we know him affectionately as the phone guy, that you're there in Florida. You're good to go. You can do work not only in Florida but across the country by being part of our phone campaign. You can work from your bedroom or your living room and be plugged in, and Mike can do that for you. So if that speaks to you, be a part of that. Go to the PDA website tonight. As I said earlier, Janice, who's a part of our social media team, she's working not only on the website but on the Facebook. Let her know that you're ready to go, and we'll plug you in to the work that's going on. In Florida, you're in a wonderful place. PDA is growing rapidly throughout the greater Florida part, whether it be in Miami with Sandy Davis, Mike Fox, as I said earlier tonight, a lot going on. And, in fact, I think personally, along my own bias, I think you've returned probably one of the best voices back to Congress in Alan Grayson. So to have Alan Grayson there in Florida and PDA growing under the leadership of Mike Fox, Sandy Davis, and Janice on the virtual and working on the social network, I encourage you tonight to be part of that. So please visit pdamerica.org and get signed up if you haven't already, so we can keep you posted. Be a part of our letter drop campaign next Wednesday. Visit your members of Congress. As I said, we're going to be at Deborah Wasserman Schultz. Ed's going to lead us to that effort, and Mike Fox and Sandy will be leading efforts in their communities. And finally, if you're in D.C. for the inaugural, as you were, Richard, 4 years ago, come to Progressive Central, meet those activists that are making a difference, and please keep in touch. Know that you're part, as I said, of a larger movement. You're not alone. Many times we're frustrated and wonder where everybody's at. We're here. We're oftentimes busy. But get signed up, get plugged in, and together we're going to turn this around, and we're well on our way in doing that. And again, I thank you for the opportunity, Richard.
Thank you so much, Tim, for joining us. We really appreciate it. Tim Carpenter, co-founder and national director of PDA America. Thanks so much. Take care.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night. Oh, that was wonderful. And now let me bring on our final guest for the evening, Dr. Rachel Sutz-Pieta. Doctor, welcome.
Hello, Richard. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing real good. We just had a fantastic interview with Tim Carpenter, and now the charming, the talented, the politically astute Dr. Rachel. Welcome.
Thank you for that introduction, Rick. It's great to be with you tonight.
Well, you know, I am always impressed by people who have spent years and years and years trying to make this a better world. And one question I ask almost every guest that I have is, you know, what was it in your life? I mean, God knows it's enough for most people to make a living, have a family, have friends, try to live a life, try to make a living. And yet there are these incredible people out there that try not only to do that, but to do something good for the world. Could you talk a little bit about yourself growing up and what was that said to you, you have to help?
Well, I grew up in a pretty politically active family in New York State, and they were all Democrats at the time. That has changed over the years, unfortunately. But I grew up with people who were involved. They were on the town council. They ran for office. They worked on campaigns. And it was my mother was also a union representative, a union organizer in upstate New York for the New York State Nurses Association. So I really had this model growing up that you were supposed to get involved. You were supposed to vote. My parents took me with them to vote. So from a pretty young age, it was communicated to me that citizenship was an active thing. You were supposed to do that.
Oh, that's so insightful. It really is. And you know, when I hear that it's a family value for you, growing up, you knew you had to participate. I was fortunate enough. I had family members like that myself. My mother was very, very civically engaged, and I got the sense that if I wanted a better world, I better be prepared to put my shoulder to the wheel.
Exactly. That is exactly it. Absolutely. You, I was told that you should, my dad was kind of always of the mind that you should question authority, always ask why. That was his perspective. So that was my orientation to involvement from the very beginning was, well, you have to ask them why. So that sort of has been how I've lived my life, making sure that I'm always asking the questions. Well, why? Why are we doing that?
So you've been involved in Democratic politics for a long time yourself. When did you first get involved?
Well, I got involved more in the organized stuff. I had done some things with, like, youth in government growing up as a kid in New York, but I got involved really in the Democratic Party in Florida as a college student at University of Florida. And I had gotten involved on campus, and when I'll show my age here, when Bill Clinton ran in 1992, I was 20 years old, and I got involved with college Democrats working to help him get elected in Florida. And that really kind of set the course for me. After that, I worked to help Governor Childs get elected, and then also helped Karen Thurman on her second election to Congress. And got to intern in, at the time, Democratic Senator Kirkpatrick's office, and I got to learn what it meant to be a Democrat in name only, because he wasn't necessarily the kind of Democrat that I had grown up with, but that was an education too. And then I got to go to Congress for a little while and intern in Karen Thurman's office, and then ended up here in Tallahassee, the Tallahassee area. I'm in Wakulla now, but I went to graduate school in Tallahassee, and I worked for the Florida legislature. I had an internship. It was really a fellowship for graduate school where you got to work in the House of Representatives or the Senate. I worked in the House side, and I worked for the Committee on Education, K-12, for a year, and they paid for, 30-something hours of my graduate master's degree and also paid me a stipend, and the education I got during that year was amazing. So since then, it's been... That's kind of the foundation for it all.
It must have been interesting working on education in the legislature. I hope it was a different time than we have these days.
Actually, it was the time that set the course for where we are now. I was assigned to call Texas and find out about standardized testing that George Bush had done as governor of Texas, because their Republicans had just taken over. It was the legislature had gone Republican for the first time since Reconstruction in Florida. That was when Speaker Webster came in. And then we were really moving in the direction of having the Republican Jeb Bush A-plus plan in education. And one of my tasks was, because there was legislation being pushed to get in the school grading system, I had to call Texas and say, well, how does this work with the standardized testing thing? And Texas said, oh, my gosh, don't do that in Florida. It's been terrible here. And I said, gee, thanks. I don't think that we're going to have a choice. And that was – and then after that, we got FCAT. We got the A-plus grading plan. And I was working in the legislature when all that happened, when the groundwork was laid for it. So it was – it was an education. It was very much like, oh, how do I stick my finger in that dam and hold the water back? And, you know, as a little graduate student assigned to do policy and support legislators and all that, there wasn't a whole lot I could do except learn.
Well, you know, what you're telling me brings up an interesting aspect. And, you know, so many of us in the progressive community have had, I'm going to speak frankly, a love-hate relationship with the party. You know, yeah. we see that the party has these extremes, and you know, while I can say that the Keith Ellisons, the Graysons, the Raul Grijalvas of the party, I can fully embrace and support, And yet we see the Baucuses and we see the Liebermans and we see party people who Ben Nelson out of Oklahoma, who aren't like any kind of Democrat I ever imagined in my wildest nightmares. You've been in both boats. You've worked with conservatives. You've worked with progressives, and now you find yourself involved in the progressive camp. What's it like? What moved you? I know your roots were in some union organizing. What was it in you? What tilted the balance in you toward the progressive side of things?
Well, I really had a culture shock when I first moved to Florida as a teenager. I really did. I moved to Central Florida, Sumter County, Florida.
Wow.
And with my parents, lived there for 2 years before going to college. And my introduction to politics in Florida was, this is an upside-down world. This was the late 80s, and Martinez was still governor, and we had just they had just overturned Janet, you know, the whole Janet Reno had just managed to overturn the open carry law.
Right.
And there was just a lot of craziness, and I was really in culture shock because I didn't, things like desegregation were sort of a memory where I lived an hour outside New York City,
right.
And in Florida there were still places under court order being bust in the late 80s, and
right.
People still referred to like a school as, oh, that's the black high school, even though now it's an integrated middle school.
Right.
And I saw that progressives, at that point, the Democrats I met weren't that progressive. And I actually really questioned, as I got ready to register 6 months before my 18th birthday, if I could be a Democrat in Florida. Thank goodness I went to University of Florida and I met more, you know, a wider umbrella of Democrats and realized, oh, okay, that was a pocket. And I started to learn about what it meant to be a Blue Dog Democrat and a Dixie Democrat and those kinds of things that I didn't know about coming from New York. So I realized that there were different camps, and I gravitated to the progressive side of things pretty early. So even though I throughout my life worked for different types of Democrats, I've always been leaning towards the progressive side. I got involved with education issues pretty early, also women's issues pretty early. I've always been a strong women's advocate. I've worked as a women's studies professor as well as an education professor, and I also was a victim advocate for rape victims for 4 years in graduate school. So my progressive roots really are probably based in human rights issues and thinking that the progressive side of things is really about putting the people over the politics. And that, I think that kind of guides me. It's kind of a social justice perspective
mm-hmm.
for my way of thinking. And when I look for a home in politics, I'm looking for the group that I think has the most heart. And I think the progressives have heart.
Yeah, I moved to Florida in 67 and from Pittsburgh. And I moved into what I discovered to my absolute shock was a segregated high school. And here I'm watching Dr. King being beaten in the streets for basic human rights, and the high school I attended didn't want to let African American or Hispanic Americans even in the room. They were not
Amazing.
Permitted in the high school band. I could not believe that I was in America.
Exactly. That was my reaction. And, you know, 20 years later, I had the same reaction moving to Florida. Actually, I thought, oh, am I still in the United States? Wow. So
that's when I began to disabuse myself of the idea that you could be born into civilization and automatically have its values.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely not. Socialization.
Okay, so we translate ourselves now in the year 2013, and you're a board member of the Progressive Democratic Caucus.
Talk
a little bit about your work with the Progressive Democratic Caucus.
I helped to found the Progressive Democratic Caucus this past year, and so I'm a founding member of the board of directors. And I was pretty excited when we hatched this idea to have a progressive caucus in Florida. It was a progressive voice often gets lost in Democratic politics in Florida.
It has been unwelcome from time to time, I understand.
Yeah, exactly. Unwelcome from time to time. And, of course, we had just seen Representative Grayson lose, so he wasn't elected when we were forming our caucus. But actually, Alan Grayson was the speaker at our inaugural meeting when we had our organizational meeting at the Democratic State Convention. We invited him to be our speaker to kick it off to a standing room only room with a couple hundred people. So we felt that people were hungry for a progressive home in the Democratic Party, and I'm really excited that we've been able to provide that.
Absolutely. So one of the reasons I wanted to invite you on was to talk a little bit about how you see the party evolving and changing. I'd like you to use your professional insight and group dynamics. How can progressives make the most impact in what is obviously a party with a broad spectrum of opinion?
Yeah, putting on my sociologist hat, my academic discipline in education is sociology of education. I study organizations and culture. And the Democratic Party is definitely a culture within a culture, and it has a lot of different subcultures. So one group would be the progressives. And we, as a group, we probably often find ourselves feeling a little disenfranchised and a little angry with the direction that things are going. There is, within the Democratic Party, there would be a left, a right, and a middle. It's a continuum, and people fall on different spots in it. One thing that progressives, the role that progressives serve is to be that voice standing on the left-hand shoulder of the party writ large, saying, remember who we are, remember what our values are, remember what we stand for. I would posit that the right-hand side, the more conservative branch of the Democratic Party, would be the historical memory of the Democratic Party, who says, look where we came from, we should move slowly. The progressive side of the party says, oh no, full speed ahead, take the brakes off, let's go, we've waited long enough. And that moderate center tries to mediate between the two and figure out the practical side of it. Where is the money, where are the votes in order to get that done?
Well, great. Now, you want to talk
there's
us about...
There's a place for the progressive in the Democratic Party, and we've got to realize that we're, even when we're not successful, we're serving an important purpose.
You want to talk a little bit about Wakula?
It's Wakala, and yes, I would.
Thank you.
Wakala is an interesting place where we're right in that big bend, just kind of as the panhandle begins south of Tallahassee. And we are a very rural county. A good portion of our population commutes to work in Leon County. And we, while we're still predominantly Democratic in registration, we have about 9,700 registered Democrats to a little over 5,000 registered Republicans, and then about 2,800 other independent, what have you, registered. Only 31,000 people live in the county. So we are a very small county. We've got more trees than we have people.
Are they, if I can quote the former candidate of the Republican Party, are they the right size trees?
That's a very good question. I don't think I want to touch that one. but a lot of our Democrats in McCulloch County probably don't always vote Democratic. Our Democratic Executive Committee in this county is probably more progressive than the average Democrat. And that is that's a balancing act for us in this county. We had a nice group of people come out to volunteer for the presidential campaign this year. And, you know, definitely the more progressive folks in the county were the ones who gravitated to doing that. But we still definitely have some folks who are, they're old school Democrats. And they're Democrats because Daddy was a Democrat and Grandpa was a Democrat and everybody back to the Civil War was a Democrat. That doesn't mean that they're necessarily in line with modern-day Democratic Party ideals or even progressive ideals.
Well, you know, I would love to have you back again because there's so many other aspects of this. I'd love to ask. But let me ask you one quick one if I can. I hate to... Well, no, we really shouldn't. Let me just thank you so much for joining us. And I'll let you send in your answers.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
I'll let you send in your answers. You can revise and extend your remarks at some other time. Thanks so much for joining us, Doctor.
Thanks, Rick. Have a good night. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. See you soon. Ladies and gentlemen, this is News Director Rick Spezak. I thank you for joining us. I do want to mention some of our colleagues in the progressive radio community. You should definitely also listen to Gwen Holden Berry's show, Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton's show, Progress Toward Democracy, Susan Nylon's show, The Nylon Report, and Anita Stewart's Wise Women Media. On behalf of myself and my co-producer, Ms. Mickey Royce, I want to thank you for joining us. And friends, you know, it's going to be a good world if we make it so. So let's make it so, my friends. Let's make it so. Talk to you next week. And keep up the good work.
Tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed them all. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly down. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suit, ah, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare